My name's Dean Metheringham. I follow the other two guys who've done wonderfully this morning and led us so far. And the session that I have will build on them and on other sessions. I'm on first thing again tomorrow morning, so today I'm going to be speaking on the power of darkness, but tomorrow talking about the one who destroys the works of the devil. So they are two studies that are somewhat part of a piece. And that means that today won't all be said that can be said, that will be done tomorrow. So I mention that now so that you're aware that that's the way I'm going. So I'll be here early in the morning because we need to hear the good news in the morning. That's just a simple way so you can pick that up. I want to read to you now as I lead into the study from Luke chapter 22, short paragraph, where at verse 47 Jesus says, it says of Jesus, while Jesus was still speaking, suddenly a crowd came, and the one called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus said to him, Judas, is it with a kiss that you betray the Son of Man? When those who were around saw him and saw what was coming, they asked, Lord, shall we strike with a sword? And then one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear, his right ear. But Jesus said, no more of this. And he touched his ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple police and the elders who had come for him, have you come out with swords and clubs as if I were a bandit? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this is your hour and the power or the authority of darkness. This is your hour. The power of darkness coincides then with my theme, which is the power of darkness. And here Jesus is intimating first to his own disciples and those who are with him and now to us that the forces of darkness were given authority to exert their full destructive powers against Christ. Significant move. Jesus can see the reason for the way in which his human opponents, mostly religious, were driven to arrest him. He sees that as his appointed time or hour. The assault of Christ's enemies had been gathering weight right through his ministry. They reached their climax in what we would call the fullness of time, or at Jesus' hour, which he so frequently talks about in John's Gospel. But only then could the clock of Good Friday begin to strike. And Jesus conclude his time on the cross, as it were, and his suffering, in his anguish and redemption by crying out, "It is finished." That is, I have brought to completion all that you have given me to do. So Christ follows the Father's plan. In that plan, evil forces are going about their business, and even the powers of evil contribute towards that actual time coming. But it is the Father's time. Once we mention the power of darkness, we have a number of responses, probably in your imagination. One could be ho-hum. I doubt it. But once I mention that, some people are likely to fall over laughing, really, at what they may think it's a kind of hocus-pocus novelty. In preparing for this, you can go through a number of theological books, in fact, and not find anything in the index about this particular subject. The other side of that is, of course, there are others that love the deep things of Satan. We got our Bibles out straight away, racking around to try and tidy it all up and get a good system of evil. But we somehow do that as well as try to remain intellectually sterilized so that we won't become involved with it. However, even though you try to keep safe, either by indulging in it or by reasoning our way around it, we are all involved. There is not one of us, me or you, who are not in some ways confronted with and involved in this system and the way in which it works. On the point of the authorities and sovereignty of the powers of darkness, one prominent theologian, and I hesitated whether I'd name him or not for fear that sends people spinning, but Karl Barth has this to say. To quote, it's a reasonably long quote, "If, that is these powers, work only as if they were legitimate, this as if is clear and convincing and even forceful enough to fill man with respect for them and continually to deliver him up to their authority. No adjuring of human freedom, no overlooking, no forgetting or denying is any help here. They are not just supports, but the motors of society. They are the secret guarantee of man's small and great conventions, customs, habits, traditions, and institutions. They are hidden wire pullers in man's great and small enterprises, his movements, achievements, and revolutions. They are not just potencies, but the real factors and agents of human progress, regress, and stagnation in politics, economics, scholarship, technology, and art, and also of the evolutions and retardations in all the personal life of the individual. We are all involved. None of us is exempt. Not even the most brilliant is exempt in some way. In fact, their brilliance may give cause to that taking place, as the speakers earlier today indicated. You can only understand the powers of darkness in the light of Christ and his confrontation with them. Sure, we can echo and put a string of verses or a material we collect from all sorts of sources together and parade them out, but you can only understand the nature of those powers in reality as the light lights up the darkness. There is in the Bible actually no theology of Satan or demons or the powers of evil, no theology as such. They are spoken of there, but there's actually no theology of them. We have to come, there's a theology of Christ, if you like, and who he is and what he's about, but the Bible doesn't give a lot of attention, it doesn't put Satan on the stage to admire him, and so on. My purpose then, in the study, may say we've talked about the fall of human beings, our idolatries, and now we're talking about the power of darkness, which includes demonic powers, and we may say, where does that fit in the picture of the theme of the overall school? Or the overall theme of the school. And as I understand it, my mandate is to see the destructive force of the powers of darkness and the way in which they distort our understanding, closely linked with what Ray has just said, but also see the way in which those powers demean us and limit us, and make abject slaves of men and women, so that we end up as pathetic creatures rather than robust human beings created in the likeness and image and glory of God. That's where I'm headed. Now, the master manage all this is Satan, but let me illustrate what I've just said. I was reading Michael Green's book that I Believe in Satan's Downfall, which is not a bad book. One of the better ones around. And he tells this instance that in Oslo, in the heart of the city, there is there a bridge, and on either side of the bridge, a number of very famous bronze statues. On one side of the bridge is of a person, I think a man. On the other side, there is a bronze statue of a couple. And around each of them is a circle. And the circle in the artist's mind is indicating that modern man today, is actually in a circle from which they cannot get out. They are gripped by forces and powers greater than themselves. That's what we're about. So the master manager and strategist of darkness is the devil, or Satan, or sometimes that serpent and other such words. And this passage has been mentioned earlier, but it needs to be re-said, not to correct anything, but to add to it. In John chapter 8 and verse 44, Jesus says, "You are from your father the devil." And by the way, whenever we talk about demons and Satan and stuff, we usually think of people involved in witchcraft, who are demonised or into the spookies. But here, he's actually speaking to Pharisees. As Ray said, good evangelicals. No, they're trapped in a circle of biblical verses. I'm not demeaning the Bible in any way. I accept its authority and seek to preach and live under it as the word of God. But you can abstract that from God and it'll imprison you. Imprison you like hell. So he says, you are of your father's, you choose your father's desires. And then he says, he was a murderer from the beginning. He does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks according to his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Notice, he was a murderer. He doesn't stand in the truth. There's no truth in him. When he speaks out of what he is, as we do, and so he lies. Now, when we look at that, we may say, well, the idea of murderer is really terrible. That's such a destructive thing, and we're all against murder. But in contrast, lies seem somewhat harmless. I mean, you just do it like winking. So they seem quite harmless, and so they're somewhat acceptable to us. We just call them white lies or something. But you see, what the passage is actually saying is the devil begins his murderous work by lying. Say that again. The devil begins his murderous, destructive work by lying. In order to destroy, he lies. Takes us with him. So we're told he's the arch deceiver. In being untruth, the devil spreads untruth. In spreading untruth, he divides what should be held together. In spreading untruth, he divides humankind from their creator and from God their father. In spreading untruth, he divides humankind from one another, and he divides us from ourselves, so that we often speak about being at odds with ourselves, not at home with ourselves. And he divides us from the creation. Now we have all sorts of systems to sustain that. So that really means that the devil negates what is true. He is an imitator. And he's a parasite. But he disabled with his lies and that sort of approach. He destabilizes and he falsifies. In a moment we'll see how that takes place. But I need to say just straight off, our society, our culture, is a sign or a picture of Satan or the devil's writing, and his activities are embedded in our lifestyle. Lying is habitual. Ray said some very positive things about young people, which I want to sustain, but I want to read you this as well, which is in a recent copy of The Australian. And it actually says that in America, where a comprehensive survey was taken in 2008 on ethics of American youth, and that's been published by a non-profit organisation, but it actually says that it finds that 83% of public school and private religious school kids lied to their parents about something quite significant in the last year. Then goes on to say, boys and girls are equally prepared to cheat, which is lying and stealing. And the same is another way, 33% of the students admit stealing something from a shop in the past year, etc. I'm not saying that to lampoon young people. What I'm saying is they've learned certain habits from us and from our advertising programs. And I'm not even saying that to make everyone feel guilty. I'm saying to illustrate the fact that lies are endemic in our culture. And I have to say, as a minister, I often find lies endemic in congregations. People lie about being baptised. Can't believe it. I had to take my elders with me before they actually believed that happened. That isn't an interview. So we have certain problems. My study is not on lying. It's just simply to point out, though, that that is the way in which we're caught in a certain web. And I'm not saying those people are demonised, but I'm saying we've fallen for it. So the powers of darkness and the powers of lying denaturalise our being humans. It's natural to be a human being. Others have told you it's a glorious thing to be a human being. It's not bad to be a human being. And as Christians, we shouldn't say after we have done something that's incorrect, wrong, or so on, oh, I'm only human, because you're putting your humanity down. It's not the fault of your humanity, it's the fault of you. But the powers of darkness do denaturalise us, and Genesis 3 tells us that, and we've looked at some of that today. But all that happens quite subtly. The devil in that account, it's a profound account in Genesis 3, but in that account, the devil does not attack Eve or Adam in a frontal way. I mean, Satan does not approach you as Dracula. It's while you're in church praying that a weird thought comes into your head, and in the quietness, you get a good strategy to sort it out straight after the service. Otherwise, why do things happen after church happen? A lot of people have been thinking all sorts of stuff during the service. So it's all nice, and you may even think you've got God on your side. The Lord told me. Oh, yeah? Right, okay. But you have to understand that. So you see, it comes through a dialogue. It is a dialogue. It's a conversation. And with a representative from the creation. A serpent, yes, but probably beautiful and attractive. Otherwise, why would you engage? And in the dialogue, man, Eve, Adam, make their own contribution. So it's a two-way thing. But the lie of the serpent is primarily, as you've picked up already, is to distort God and distort who God is. And in some ways, it gives the impression, however you put it, gives the impression that God is not all he's actually indicated he is. He's not actually truthful. He's not told you the whole story. How could God say, I belong to him, but he's done this? Once that happens to you, it's all over except the shouting. You're done. You're done there. Done like a dinner. And if you pray very hard, you still got that in your head, no amount of prayer will fix it. Not that sort of prayer anyway. Caught with it. So it distorts, God is distorted, and so the serpent uses the word of God in order for mankind, for man, to catch sight of something before he'd not imagined. Hitherto, it was impossible. Oh, now I see new possibilities. Ever have those sort of dreams? Gee, some of our possibilities are really quite demonic. So the possibilities indicate that upon what basis the woman and the man could actually be gods. More than human. Denaturalised. Not good enough being human. Got to be more. So they would become divine. And there's a lot of stuff in our media these days and some parts of theology which say we're all divine. Man or humankind who's made in the image of God, being made in the image of God, we're creatures. But now the creature makes a creator. Creature makes a creator, and he makes the creator in his own image, or an image which suits him, to meet his comforts and his needs. The lie really admits that there's nothing beyond man. Man is limitless. And that's what our society still believes, including our Prime Minister. Sorry, I have to say that. We can fix everything. Well, if you're in the position where you think you can solve all your own problems, well, then you're right on, because it's just you that'll have to do it. And no one else. And in that instance, even if you ask a God to pray to help you, you're stuck with you. Frightening experience when you think about it. Many churches are starting to discover some amazing things. We've discovered in my denomination we can't convert people. Oh, that's a new thought. The intention to see people converted is a step up for us. So let me not negate all that. But we've come to the hard reality. Can't do it. We do fantastic things, so I'm not anti-human or anti-human enterprise. We're fantastic creatures and very creative. And excuse me, our technology has saved many lives and so on. But we trust it. Humankind, then, when it's denaturalised, experiences a number of things, but amongst them, the Genesis account tells us, and that is implied by other places, it implies that, in actual fact, we experience a thing called shame. So the concluding part of Genesis 3 says, at verse 7, after they'd taken the fruit and desired to be wise, she took the fruit and ate, and gave some to her husband who was with her and a joint collaborator in the enterprise, and the eyes of both were opened. The devil had said, you'll know good and evil, basically. You'll be the judge of that. But it doesn't say that here. The eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves. What did they discover? Nakedness. As they were created, it says, as they left the hands of God, as it were, in his image, glorious, says the man and his wife, were both naked and not ashamed. They faced each other without any difficulty whatsoever, and as John said to us so well yesterday, entered into a community with their bodies in that oneness without any problems. We've said, as John said, rather, or Greg rather said, I beg your pardon, Greg John said, the bodies of the man and the woman were both a sign of the creation in the image of God. Male and female bodies are the profile of our masculinity and femininity, which make us human. That is, the image of God comes through there. With our bodies, as we were told, we enter into full communion with each other as persons. You know, I was at a New Year's Eve thing, a party, which was an excellent evening out, but we got involved in a conversation while we were waiting for the long hour to come. If I had any brains at all, I'd never go to New Year parties. It's so dead the next day. But anyway, here we were, and it was an excellent evening, and a conversation comes up about communication. And people put the position to me that young people today are communicating and modern people are communicating in ways hitherto unknown through texting, through modern phone communication, through internet. There's all this communication going on, and people live in that world with their communication. And they said, that would be better than what we have at the present. And I said, no, you actually need a body. I want to touch someone. I want to see how they respond to me when I look at them. I look at you while I'm speaking, and I can tell where I'm going to some degree by the attitude of your eyes and your body language. And if I see it going like this, I know I've got to do something. So, but you can't tell that on the internet. So it's to you. What did you say?
Unless you've got a webcam.
Well, a webcam, yeah. Well, we're going to get more, but you still... It's like people sometimes say, oh, all these people are here today, but they're here in spirit. And I think, no, I want to see a body on a seat. I want to touch him. We ache for physical communication. That's what we're made for. And we may think communicating with people is so painful, we'll opt out. But it'll actually be a reaction to something, and you'll be a loner, and that'll cause you more promise than actually being involved with all the other people. So, with shame, something happens to us because within the sensation of human sexuality, intercourse, we are able to regard the other human being. And out of the community of the Godhead, of the Father, and the Son, the Holy Spirit, so within that there is giving and receiving and joy and service and love and harmony and life and creativity. With shame, human beings lose their sense of being in the image of God. We feel less because we cover. And to be consistent with what Greg was saying, our shame is primarily felt within our genitalia. We react all the time sexually. And if some people, some very spiritual people in churches where I've been say, oh, I don't have any problem with that, I think, yeah, that's your problem. Because you've canned sex. I mean, I gave a series of studies once on the Song of Solomon when I was at Coromandel Valley, and some of my most intense spiritual people stayed away. They could not cope with me talking candidly about human beings. They thought it was gross. Isn't that an interesting thing? I haven't had that problem. Anyway, so thereby the lie then, you see, brings division. And with the division comes insecurity. And with the insecurity of the whole text, if we were to go through it in Genesis 3, with the insecurity there is domination. So the woman desires a husband, but it's a sort of a wrongful kind of, almost an idolatrous sort of desire. And the man, he dominates the woman. And sure, he was created to actually have headship, but now it's domination. There's a change in the nuances and the way in which it goes. So, if you don't mind me saying this, there's a high possibility that lust replaces love. And so you have the beginning of erotic love. Now, I have to be careful with my words. Some people say lust, but I actually desire my wife. Is that lust? Not necessarily. God desires us. So if you desire your wife or your husband, that's not sinful. But if I want her because of what I get from her and she has to satisfy me, then I have a problem you talked about this morning. So you see, could this be really be where we are today? Goodness me, this clock goes fast. That's the devil doing that. So would that be really where we are today? So you just think of all the compensational sicknesses we have. Think of the problems we have with food and its regulation and its law system. You think of the way in which we are struggling all the time, you see, to find more and more pleasure. And a guy I heard just over a year ago called Arch Hart, while talking about marriage and sexuality in a course I did, said when someone asked him about how he thought marriages would eventually be repaired in our culture, I quote him, and he said, "Marriages may recover when less attention is given to sexual genitalia in relationships." Amen. See, you exaggerate it because you can't cope with it. And you cover it because you're afraid of it. Then you exploit it and become a grandstander because in actual fact that's the way you're dealing with it. So it leads to division and corruption and orgies and all sorts of terrible things. The power of darkness includes what is called in the Bible principalities and authorities or powers. I will deal with this again tomorrow, so I'm going to cut short what I need to do now to cover that properly. So I'll see if I can summarise that without going through all the text. That includes demons, who, as we heard from Colossians in Martin's talk last night, everything, all powers and dominions and authorities were created through Christ. So the devil is not God, he's a created being. And he had authority to gather cohorts alongside of him. It's another story called, we sometimes call demons or powers, and there's a whole story as to how all that comes together. But there are also human powers created by God, and we sometimes call them the powers that be, say in Romans 12, where it says Christians are required to obey the powers, the authorities, government, state governments. But they become a network of agencies able to make decisions and exert pressure. And when we talk about demons, Paul says that demons are often associated with idolatry, if not always associated with idolatry. That doesn't mean the people who are necessary idol worshippers are demonized, but they are at work there, so Satan and the lie is taking place there, and the bondage and the destructive and the murderous intent is being worked out there. We can't actually live with without those authorities and powers. We can't live without them. But the powers are also a source of unmitigated evils that can be investigated with demons. So I would think that today we'd say that the government in Zimbabwe is somewhat demonised, as was National Socialism. But as also sometimes can the FBI be demonised. Let me mention two out of the range of them. First, the power of fashion exercises immense control over our lives. I mean, where does it come from? I heard a program on the radio once when I was out driving and was talking about where the fashion came from for lads to wear their caps back to front. And they speculated and speculated. But why did it have such a hold? Why does it get such a hold? I'm not condemning it. There's nothing morally wrong with it. Though if you want to serve a lad communion with he's got his cap pulled down, you have to say, could you just pull it off? Anyway, there's nothing wrong there. But is it good or bad? Well, I'm not going to answer that. That's the problem with it. But who or what really determines fashion? Are we overtly controlled then by what Paul calls elemental spirits that are at work in laws of secularity? See, secularism is moving to eliminate God from every part and portion and corner of our thinking and our society. That's a system. No government, really, I don't think at the moment in Australia, has ever thought of putting that on their agenda. It's not there. So what would happen today if, in my message tomorrow, if Christ freed you from your slavery to fashion? Well, he wouldn't take it so seriously. I mean, in our place, there's a wife and two daughters around, and they've got kind of a security system on the front door, and it's got loud speakers on it. When I'm going out to the front door, I hear a voice that says, "You're not going out with that shirt on, are you?" Oh, right. But it's not restricted to Roz. I turn up this morning to a prayer meeting, and I stand up on the platform, and not only here, but very religious people come up and say to me, "Did you leave your pyjamas on?" I mean, it's So when you are free from it, you should be able to joke about it. But some of us are held in a tyranny of lies about all what that means and about your persona and who you are and your value and devalue and what you look like and how you present. It has become a tyranny to our younger people and older people. They're trapped by it. Second, the financial system mentioned by Martin last night, and he gave us good testimony as to what that's meant for him. It can make you tremble with joy, as it was 2 years ago, or bring you to misery, as it is now. But the collapse of the Western monetary system starkly tells us, yells at us, what authority it exercises. I mean, how do we know? How does the greatest economist work it all out? Commentators speculate interest rates are going to go up, and they almost plead for them to change. Then they drop. I haven't time to go into that, but we are a consuming, investing society. We no longer live on what we produce, but on what we invest. We're trapped. You're trapped in that. Many Christians are trapped by fear, because see, all that has guilt in it. That's why Paul in Galatians 4 talks about elemental spirits, because he talks about not so much the law of God, the law of Moses, but all the laws that work in our society. And our society is creating books of laws every day. That causes a lot of stress for us. So if you are freed from that, we'll come back to that tomorrow, because money is something that seems to act by itself, and it's a law to itself. Jesus personified it and called it mammon. He made it a god. So if you're freed from that, what could happen? Well, I think likewise, you have to sort of learn how to somehow work it out and talk a bit more sensibly. I want to read a quote that I read at our state synod, back in October, when we discovered that about 24% of all the synod's investments have fallen off. The United Church is not going to go broke, but it can't invest, can't do things now. Okay, so I've got some advice for you. If you had purchased $1,000 of Nortel's stock 1 year ago, it would now be worth $49. If you'd bought it taken it with Enron, you would have had $16.50 left of your original $1,000. With WorldCom, you would have had less than $5 left. If you'd purchased $1,000 of Delta Airline stocks, you would have been left with $49. But if you'd purchased $1,000 worth of beer and wine a year ago, drank all the beer and wine, and then turned the bottles in for recycling, for a refund, you would have had $214. So my advice, with Ian Pentecook's and Martin Bleeby's background, is our advice to you is, on current investment situation, is drink heavily and recycle. You can see, though, I've made the humour because we take a lot of this stuff too seriously. However, it does not minimise the seriousness of the lie that we've actually been caught in its web. And many of us are people with that circle around us, and we're bound. There are Christians today, Christians who are bound. So what a fantastic thing would happen if at this school, through various speakers, but primarily for the word of God, you were released from that fear and you viewed your financial situation and your property stuff and all that you do have to invest in a different way, and you're free enough to actually say, well, I'm on my retirement income has dropped significantly. Wouldn't it be fantastically freeing if you could just tell yourself in a relaxed way, well, it's no big pain to cancel the trip to Europe next year? No, it's not. It's no big problem. It just can alter your lifestyle. You're not going to starve. And, you know, we can actually give some money away, which might open the floodgates again. Wouldn't that be the action? Because, you see, Christ encountered the powers of darkness. That's what I have to deal with tomorrow, but I finish it at this point. God appointed a time of confrontation. And Jesus must confront and overcome their tenacious, real act of power if we're to be set free from their control and the wreckage they are inflicting on our lives. The reason why the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil.